Coming up on this week's episode of Check Your Balances, we talk about backdoor Roth conversions, target date funds, and a spinoff. Stick around. That's coming up next.
Check Your Balances is a show produced and owned by Kraftwerk Capital. The views expressed by the hosts and their guests are personal opinions and should not be considered personal financial advice or the opinion of Kraftwerk Capital. All investments have risk and may lose money. Consult with your financial advisor, tax preparer, or attorney prior to implementing anything discussed, and please do not use this show as the sole basis for financial decisions.
Welcome back to another week of Check Your Balances. I am Ross Anderson, joined as always by my friend and co-host, Dan Maseka. Good to see you, my friend.
Good to see you, and I'm feeling fairly smug this morning after the emails you sent me from our listeners this week.
Are you? What's going on?
I seem to have a lot of support in my methodology for making peanut butter and jelly sandwiches with a single utensil as opposed to using multiple utensils for spreading peanut butter and jelly.
That is true. Several people wrote in support of your method on how they make a peanut butter and jelly. And I don't take any shame in this. I think I even said I don't make a lot of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. So it's not something where I'm worried about my technique being shaded here. That being said, using a second utensil to me is like absolutely no big deal. And this is why I learned way later in life than I should have that the silverware caddy in a dishwasher, it's much easier if you just pull it out of there and then you unload it near your utensil drawer rather than pick the things out one by one and move them. That's how I used to do it as a kid. I didn't realize the thing came out. I'm embarrassed to admit that publicly, but that is the truth.
I think I developed the single utensil strategy out of pure laziness. But the other thing is, for a while, my house didn't have a dishwasher. So I was hand washing every single thing I used. And to whatever extent I could avoid one more thing to wash, I was happy.
You know, I think it's funny that even on something as simple as how do you make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, our answer comes back to it depends, Dan. That's what we answer every single question with. And that leads us in to today's show because we are doing a mailbag episode where we dive into the mailbag. We see what you, our listeners, are wanting to talk about. And we've got several really good ones here that I think we're going to have some fun with. So should we dive right in, Dan?
Let's go for it.
All right. So the first one we are going to do today comes to us from Steven. Steven's question is about the backdoor Roth. He says, how is a backdoor Roth legal? They seem wrong. Somehow with AGI limits, do we expect the IRS to act or issue new guidance? With the federal government seeking more cash, it seems like a honeypot of cash. How do you set up a backdoor? Can you do it on your own? Do you need some three-letter credentialed person like a CFA, CFP, CPA to do this for you? He says he and his wife are over the AGI limits. They've got a traditional 401k that's dormant, a 457, a simple IRA, and some other brokerage accounts, but no Roth. Do I need one? Feels like I do. What's your take on Steven's question?
It's a great question. And the reason it feels like it might be illegal is because it exists because of a loophole. And a loophole is something that maybe wasn't intended when they were writing the law, but it's there. But before we answer the question, let's talk about what a backdoor Roth IRA is, because some people might not know that. So we all know the Roth IRA. You can contribute money after tax. It grows tax deferred, and you can pull it out tax-free. Beautiful vehicle, but there are restrictions as to who can contribute to that based on their AGI. If you have exceeded that AGI limit and can no longer directly contribute to a Roth IRA, you can utilize this backdoor strategy by making an after-tax contribution to an IRA. So sometimes those can be pre-tax, but you can make an after-tax contribution to the IRA. And there are no restrictions on how much or when you can convert IRA money to Roth IRAs. So again, in this strategy, you would make the after-tax contribution, then convert that money to a Roth IRA. And that essentially is what a backdoor Roth IRA contribution looked like.
Right. So you're basically using a door that doesn't have an income limit to get into something that does, because the second transaction doesn't have any restrictions on it, on how or when you can do that. The reason it feels illegal, by the way, is something that is rooted in common law practice, which is called the step transaction doctrine. And this is something that the IRS does enforce in certain cases, which is essentially that if you put together two transactions to do something and use a loophole like this, that basically they're going to be viewed as one. That if you have two legal transactions and together they make an illegal transaction, they could view them as one and challenge it. And so this is a reminder that tax is not as black and white as we might like to think it is. Like, there are certainly things that are black and white. There are certainly legal and not legal things and the way you're supposed to do it. But in this case, I actually think that it's a little bit of how conservative or aggressive do you want to be? And I'll give you an example. So I reached out to a CPA recently for a client that was doing this exact strategy and said, what do you think in terms of a waiting period or a soaking period? The reason that you might do that is exactly what we're talking about. If you do the non-deductible contribution and immediately convert it to a Roth, it becomes fairly clear, if that was challenged, that this is basically one transaction that you intended. If you make the non-deductible contribution and you waited 10 years and then did the conversion to a Roth, I would suggest that it's fairly clear that it wasn't a single transaction, that you were kind of doing those things independently. So the question then becomes, well, how long should you wait to do this? The CPA I reached out to recommended a month, but some people will do it immediately. Now, to my understanding, the IRS has not been challenging these transactions, but they certainly could. And so as you think about this and work with your tax professionals, you don't need one to do this, by the way, but I would recommend it. If you're considering it, I think how long you wait, how long you let the money soak in the account is a reasonable consideration. And it should be taken with how aggressive do I want to be and would I be willing to stand up to a challenge if the IRS challenged the transaction?
So even though there are some complicated factors associated with making a backdoor Roth contribution, you can certainly do this on your own. Setting up the accounts and doing the transfers are fairly easy with almost any brokerage you're going to use. You need a traditional IRA setup, a Roth IRA. Your money goes into the traditional IRA, and be mindful of the limits. You can only contribute up to $6,500 a year if you're under 50. Then that money would move to the Roth IRA in the form of a conversion, and you're done. But even though you can do this simply on your own, there are other things you should be wary of to make sure you're not creating a mess for yourself.
Yeah, the pro rata rule is the big one. And there's even a hint to this in Stephen's question where he says that he's got a simple IRA. So a simple IRA means that he's likely got pre-tax money in that simple IRA. That's what we would suspect is going on there. And that is going to be included as part of any possible Roth conversion. So any IRA that has pre-tax money in it is considered as a pro rata portion of the backdoor Roth conversion. And so, for example, if he's got $10,000 in his simple and then tries to do a $6,500 backdoor Roth, it's really $16,500 and only the $6,500 is the after-tax basis. And so you would have a situation where you're doing a conversion and the bulk of that conversion, more than 50% of that conversion, is actually going to be taxable when you do it. The key here, though, is that remember the I and IRA is individual. So if you've got an individual retirement account for yourself, but maybe your spouse doesn't, it's possible that you could do this backdoor strategy for the spouse, but not for yourself with no tax impact or very little tax impact. So who has IRAs is really critical here as you consider whether or not this makes sense for you.
And to address the end of your question, do you need a Roth IRA? It feels like you do. If the stars align and the situation is right for you, I think there are a lot of reasons you might consider getting money into a Roth IRA, especially if you have extra capacity for saving. But again, that's determined on an individual basis. So you have to go through the checklist that we talked about, make sure you have all of your savings already lined up if you're going to be making additional savings beyond what you're doing to your simple IRA and all the other plans you have in force.
All right. Clear as mud, Dan. Let's get into our next question today. This one comes to us from Brian. Brian writes in and says, how do target date funds actually work? He quotes the Fidelity website and says, per Fidelity, target date funds gradually become more conservative, increasing their allocation to bonds, cash, or cash equivalents. The mix of assets that adjust throughout the life of the fund is known as the glide path. He says, great, but how is this done? Are they selling assets to fund the purchase of bonds? Won't that create a taxable event? Or are they slowly and progressively allocating more of my invested money into bonds instead of stocks? Can you go over an example of somebody putting money into one of these and what happens as it gets closer to the retirement age? Dan, do you want to talk through this? Because I think there's a little bit of just how mutual funds work in this question, as well as how target dates specifically work.
Yeah, there are a lot of moving pieces here. I think to start with, when you're contributing to a mutual fund, let alone a target date fund, they're not doing anything specifically with your dollars for you. You are buying into a pot of money of which you own a little slice. So they're taking all the dollars coming into that fund from everyone and managing that pool of money, and you are allocated a small percentage of that depending on how much you own.
Yeah, so on the other side, basically Fidelity's got like a big brokerage account that has their fund in it. So if it's the 2050 fund, there's a huge account that has everybody's money. And on an ongoing basis, most people are going to be putting money into those funds during the early life of the fund because they're intended for people that are younger. Now, why would money be coming out? Like if you're in your 401k and you choose to sell the 2050 fund, even if you are not anywhere near retirement, Fidelity would have to deal with a redemption request in that case. So there is both money coming in and money coming out of a mutual fund at really any given time. Sometimes that money is going to line up. So if the money coming in is more than the money going out, they might simply be using cash to deal with the redemptions, right? They're giving money coming in the door to the people that are asking for it on the backside, and they're just reallocating with the excess cash that they have coming in. But at some point, there is going to be a requirement to probably sell, rebalance, or to adjust, just like an active fund would. So if you buy, you know, somebody's large cap growth stock fund and they choose to sell one stock and buy another, they're doing that inside the big brokerage account that you own a piece of.
Correct. And in that situation, they're going to pass through any capital gains or taxable events directly to the shareholders, even if you didn't make any transactions within your fund. So it's important to be aware that mutual funds might not be very tax efficient investing vehicles, but for a lot of target date funds, you're owning them in a retirement plan anyway. So it might not matter to you. But as Ross said, they have to match up the contributions and the redemptions. And then as you mentioned in your email, there is a glide path they're following for these retirement funds. And as you get closer to that target date, they're going to sell out of the stocks and buy into the bonds. And that could be a taxable event too.
Yeah. So they could be balancing it with incoming cash, or they could be balancing it through sales, right? The key for a target date fund is that they're really agreeing to keep that target date fund in the correct mixture the entire time that you're going to own it. So whether they have to do that through buying and selling, or whether they do that through that incoming cash, is completely up to them. That's their objective. Now, again, if it's in a retirement account, we don't care, right? Because the taxable event, if it's inside your 401k or your IRA, there isn't one. They're not going to distribute those capital gains. All of the taxes when you've got a 401k or an IRA style account is going to be based on money coming into the account or out of the account for you. That's how you get the deduction against your income tax. When you put money into a 401k, when that money comes out, it is treated as income. It is not the buying and selling. Inside a brokerage account, yes, capital gains, big consideration, and you're not going to necessarily have control over that if you are a mutual fund investor. Really, even with an exchange-traded fund, you don't have control over that, except ETFs are generally based on an index that's going to be a little bit more passive, so there should be less trading going on. There's not that many companies being added to or removed from the S&P 500, for example, on a single year. And the ones that are normally going to be the smaller names. So it's not going to be a big, meaningful transaction in most cases, but that's going to happen from time to time. There is a function that has to happen if you're going to rebalance an account over time, that you're going to have some selling that goes on, whether that's on an annual basis, you're going to have dividends that get paid. Those are also taxable events. So, you know, the goal is not to avoid any taxable event ever. It's just to be thoughtful about it. Try and push as many of your gains as possible into the long-term category, and then be smart about when you're really realizing those gains. If you want more control over that, maybe a target date fund in a taxable account isn't for you.
Yeah. And as the second part of this question, our listener, Brian, asks, how this would work if you were a self-investor making contributions into an account, starting with, as an example, the S&P 500 or total market ETF and transitioning to more of a bond focus, you're going to make very similar decisions. So you're going to take the cash coming in and allocate that to the right spot for you. So at first, that might be the equity piece. Let's call it the total market index. And then as you get closer to retirement needing those funds, you might be able to allocate new dollars into those bonds, but it's possible that's just not enough to get you to the right allocation. And you'll have to sell some of that equity ETF to buy into the bonds as well, because you might just not have enough dry powder coming into the account to equalize the proportions properly.
The other way that you could do this, if you're kind of getting close and you're thinking about, well, how do I create cash and make it something a little bit safer or less volatile, you could put the dividends into bonds as well. So if you are not in a reinvesting dividends moment, right? So sometimes you can set your brokerage account to reinvest the dividends and just continually buy as it's going up. But you might choose not to do that. Have the dividends paid to cash and use that to fund the safe portion of your portfolio, which is going to get increasingly bigger. Again, it depends on where you are, how close you are to retirement, and how much you're trying to build in that safety net of, you know, cash or bond assets. But there's a few different ways that you're going to ultimately get cash into your account. It's either through selling something, cash being paid in through a dividend, or you continuing to contribute.
As an aside, the question referenced a Fidelity target date fund, and I pulled up the 2065 fund as an example just to look at what was going on under the hood. It has something like 30 to 40 funds underneath that wrapper, which is a lot. By contrast, I pulled up the Vanguard one, which owns 4 funds. Such a difference in approach that I just thought was interesting to be aware of, that different fund companies take very different styles to managing these types of vehicles.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't looked at it super recently, but we had even mentioned this before. Vanguard, I think, generally does about a third of their portfolios to international assets. Fidelity was very, very high, almost an equal weight to international stocks and U.S. stocks. That's going to have a big impact because these companies don't treat every target date fund the exact same. Between providers, you're going to have big differences between how Fidelity or T. Rowe Price or Vanguard, you know, those are the big names, but I also see them from like Victory Capital and some others. You're going to see very, very different approaches to how they manage their target date fund. The glide path matters. The fund choices underneath the hood matter. So it is worth at least, you know, go on the free version of Morningstar, morningstar.com, look at the fund and see, do you like what it's actually invested in? I think that that's worth doing, especially if you're the type of person that listens to a show like ours, is look under the hood and see what's going on in there.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, the last one we are going to do for today, this comes in from a longtime listener, Ernie. He wrote in and said, hey, J&J recently spun off its consumer products division to form a new company, Kenvue. My calculation shows the new Kenvue stock is worth about the same as my J&J stock. Why hasn't the price of J&J been cut in half since the announcement of the spinoff? J&J stock has not gone up much since the announcement of the spinoff. Is this one of those events that is priced into the stock? So anytime we're talking about individual stocks, remember, we're not recommending anybody buy, sell, or do anything with these. We're just going to talk about what happened with this spinoff / spin out, because it was kind of a unique situation on what Johnson & Johnson did with their consumer products division. So Dan, let's get into it. What did they do here?
So Kenvue was a part of Johnson & Johnson. Johnson & Johnson decided to restructure and spin off individual business units to operate as kind of individual entities. Instead, they can each focus on what they're doing, specifically instead of having to roll up to this big, massive company. As part of the spinoff of Kenvue, Johnson & Johnson gave their shareholders an opportunity to exchange shares of Johnson & Johnson for shares specifically of Kenvue. They gave you a little bit of an incentive to do so, but that was essentially what they were doing. So if you wanted to take advantage of this, you would forfeit your share of Johnson & Johnson in exchange for a new share of Kenvue. But what this is doing is not necessarily changing the value of Johnson & Johnson, because they are redeeming shares in that process. So lowering that denominator that the math is based off of, even though the enterprise value of the company might be shrinking. That might sound complicated, and it does in the way I explain it, but I think Ross might be able to back me up here a little bit.
Yeah. So basically, if you look at the market cap of these two companies, and this is a tough thing to track because market cap changes every single day with trading. And so even as the stock price is going up and down, you're seeing market cap change. But earlier in August, Johnson & Johnson had a market cap of, I think it was about $440 billion. Right now, today, as I'm looking at it, this is Thursday, August 31 that we're recording, the current market cap of Johnson & Johnson is $394 billion. So it's about $44 billion less than it was earlier this month. That $44 billion is the exact market cap of Kenvue. So if you look up what their current market cap is, $44.17 billion. What they basically did was sliced a piece of the cake and moved that out. And I think it was like an 8-for-1 share count. I think that may be where the math is getting confusing here. So I think it was one share of Johnson & Johnson for 8 shares of Kenvue, if I recall the offer correctly. But that was basically what happened, is they have removed that piece from the business, but they also deleted the shares. And so even though, you know, when we talk about a share rebuyback, that a company is buying back shares of its own company, they are shrinking the number of outstanding shares. That's also what happened here, which is why you didn't see the Johnson & Johnson price crater, is that they have removed a number of those shares and converted them into Kenvue, and they've kind of just separated those two business pieces.
Correct.
Nothing to add, Dan?
Nothing to add.
Well, we appreciate everybody that wrote in. We had gotten a number of really great questions. We had gotten some comments also on some of our talk about how difficult trust administration is and things about some of the co-trustee things that we had mentioned in a previous show. I think we're going to try and address those as well. But if you've got questions for the show, we really appreciate hearing from everybody. Check your balances at outlook.com is the email address. We hope you enjoyed tuning in this week. We will catch you all next time.